leader Khomeini. I think Israel has been committing a genocide for the last now four, and now we are entering the fifth month. And Israel is killing and overkilling and overkilling and murdering, even incubator babies, children, men, women, destroying everything, and launching war, supported, of course, by the West and by America and by EU, and by the weakness of the Arab and Muslim world and the weakness of the world as a whole. They are launching genocidal war, starvation war, propaganda war, economic war, ecological war, and another war on UNRWA. Now, the plan of Israel is ethnic cleansing. The ethnic cleansing, if they say now that they are going to evacuate them, probably they are going to take them to the death angel, to kill them all, or to force them through the Palestine Egyptian crossing, or to kill and kill, and you know, because nobody cares, and they were given a green light by the Americans, by the Europeans, and now if we analyze the situation in Israel, you see that we have religious Zionism, and we have those cabal bent on the utter destruction and elimination of the Palestinian people, and they wouldn't care for anybody, you know, because they say we do not care for what Gentile say, we care for what the Zionists do, and this is what they are doing. They are going to continue their genocide, which they started, you know, 4 months ago, and now you see the genocide, as a matter of fact, is continuing.
Right.
Now, 4 or almost 5% of the total population of Gaza are either dead or injured or buried under the rubble. And this is in addition, of course, to thousands and thousands of prisoners. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the situation is miserable, catastrophic. It has never happened anywhere in the world.
Indeed.
And they are not killing the Palestinian people. They are killing humanity, democracy, human rights, and they are exposing those slogans in the West, human rights and democracy, after their true colors, and they show how hypocritical the world is.
Indeed. Well, let's look at the U.S. role here, Hartley Steiger. I'm trying to figure it out. And when you have the U.S. President Joe Biden saying that Israel's military action was over the top, at the same time, you have the U.S. approving this $14 billion in aid on the one hand. On the other hand, you have all this military support that the U.S. has given Israel. I mean, I hate to just refer to Burrell here. He said, well, if you believe that too many people are being killed, maybe you should provide less arms in order to prevent so many people having been killed. Our guest there talks about the U.S. and the European green light. Is the U.S. saying something out in public, but in private, giving the green light to the Israeli regime?
Forget what they're saying. Biden is saying that he apparently called Netanyahu a nasty name. They leaked that to the press. They said there must be efforts to protect the civilians. You want to protect the civilians? Stop the money, stop the arms, stop the diplomatic protection. When the U.S. had a chance to do something to get a ceasefire at the UN Security Council, they vetoed it. So anyone who thinks that Biden is trying to hold back Netanyahu doesn't understand anything about who's actually running the policy. Biden's just the puppet behind an operation which includes the international banks, the defense sector, the military industrial financial complex, as we call it. And the U.S. is working hand in hand with the British on this. And, you know, if you look back at the history, you know that the British were the ones who set this whole divide and conquer situation up to use the Palestinians as essentially a punching bag for the Zionist movement. So I think the important thing for people to realize is that Biden is not necessarily speaking for the American people. The Christian Zionists in America, so-called, who aren't really Christian, but they support Netanyahu in the war. But the tide is turning against them, including in the circles around Biden. But the problem is the military-industrial complex has enormous power in the United States, and they're supporting this idea that Israel must be the dominant superpower in the region as an extension of U.S. interests. And so that's why when Biden says, go easy, we want to protect the civilians, it's meaningless. It's just babble. It's like Tony Blinken when he says he's heartbroken at looking at these children who are being killed. If you're heartbroken, stop it. The U.S. could stop it with a phone call.
Well, again, it's quite perplexing, however, when you take a look at Assad Abu Sharq, the way that the U.S. is conducting itself. And I'd like to put this in the context of the arms one more time. You know, you have the fact that the Israeli regime is conducting a bombing campaign that is unprecedented in history in terms of the land mass, the amount of ammunition, which is said to equal four times what was dropped on Hiroshima, in terms of the tons and the volume, which has led many to conclude it wants to make Gaza unlivable. The arms are provided by the U.S. So does that mean the U.S. also wants to make Gaza uninhabitable, and that is actually the goal of both the U.S. and Israel?
Yes, I think so, because, you know, this war is not led by the Israelis alone. It was led by Biden, by the EU, and from the very first few days of the war, when Biden jetted off with, you know, many European leaders to occupy Palestine, to apartheid Israel, and, you know, he gave them a green light to... you know, finish off the Palestinian people. And even all those runners for presidents in America, they say either finish off the Palestinian people or kill them all or so on and so forth. You know, these are unscrupulous, ingenuous, deceptive chameleon, political chameleons. And they do not care, as I say, for the Palestinian, for the life of the Palestinians. They care only for their own interest. And this is why, for example, look to the contradiction in what they do. They gave, for example, Ukraine well over $55 billion to defend itself. This is what they say against Russia. And they gave Israel well over $14 billion to attack and to ethnically cleanse and to wipe out the Palestinian people. This is the duplicity, this is their human rights, this is their what they call democracy, so on and so forth. So I think the West and the Americans are doing their best in order to they invest in Israel, actually, because they consider that Israel protects their own interests, which is not, of course, this is totally wrong. And at the expense, of course, they are doing that, all that at the expense of the Palestinian people, thinking that this relationship between the two colonial powers, Zionism and imperialism, and or European colonialism, Western colonialism, you know, will be fruitful. But at the end of the day, I can tell you the Palestinians are there, and these are European Zionists who came across overseas, and they must be returned to Europe, to Russia, to England, to France. To these are European Zionists. These are planters. These are settlers. They have no future in Palestine. Palestine is for the Palestinian people, and the Palestinian people are quite determined to defend their own land, to resist the occupiers. There is before all types of occupiers and colonialists, and now they are they will do their best to resist. And I think I don't think that any power on earth can defeat the resistance of a whole people. It is the Palestinian people who are fighting, who are defending themselves, who are in their own land. And I don't think that even if the whole world conspired against the Palestinian people, this is going to cause, of course, massacres. But at the end of the day, I think, and I advise the Americans and the Europeans, you should call for ceasefire, for the withdrawal of Israel,
sure,
and to call back all European citizens to their homelands in Europe. This is better for in order to have a better future and good relations with the Arab and the Muslim world in that part of the world.
Okay, so I'm gathering from both of you that the U.S. is just, I don't want to say just lying, but basically is not telling the truth. And it is given the green light. I'm understanding that from both of you. If that is the case, then what is the deal with these so-called peace talks then? Or truce talks or pause? I'm not too sure what name you'd like to call it, where it was rejected by Netanyahu the first time around, and now we're in the second round, where Netanyahu still has rejected it in the second round, but the talks are ongoing for the next few days, as it has been reported. Is that just passing time? Some are saying it's to buy time in order for Israel to continue this Rafah ground operation and in the vision of Israel to try to defeat Hamas.
Well, I think the point here is that if the U.S. was concerned about civilian casualties, it could do something about it. Yesterday at the State Department briefing, the press was challenging the State Department briefers when they said, well, we're advising Israel to use caution to limit civilian casualties. And the reporters were saying, well, if that's what you're doing, it's not working. Are you going to do more? And they said, no, we have faith in the Israeli Defense Forces and the government. They're listening to us. This is public relations. They're trying to cover for the fact that the U.S. policy is to support Israel in its plan to ethnically cleanse Gaza, to drive the Palestinians out. Look, and it's clear in terms of the attack on Rafah. You said it at the beginning of the discussion. Where can people go now? There's no other place in Palestine for them to go. They're being driven so that unless Egypt accepts them, which the Egyptians are not going to do because they're not going to be a party to ethnic cleansing, there are people who are being slaughtered by the IDF. Now, I just want to make one other point here because it's not simply a plot for genocide and so on. It's also an attempt to destroy the potential to break out of the so-called unipolar order. What the U.S. is doing is using Israel to attack the idea of an anti-colonial movement. And the Palestinian people are part of an anti-colonial movement. That we see now in the global South as a whole, particularly South Africa, raising the question of genocide at the International Court of Justice, that the global South is speaking out against imperialism. It needs to do more. We need to have in the imperial countries, in Europe, I'm here in Germany, the German government's terrible on this. They're committing another genocide by supporting Israel. But we see people in Germany, in France, in Italy, in the United States, in the streets, including some Jewish people who are anti-Zionist. So we have to build a movement that demands a ceasefire and demands that the Israelis get rid of Netanyahu and his hardcore Israeli expansionists, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who have said their goal is to wipe out the Palestinian people, not just Hamas, but the Palestinians.
Okay.
And so I think people have to get over the illusion that the United States is trying to be an honest broker here.
Indeed. And talk about wiping out. That is one of the goals that Assad Abu Sharq, Israel, has had when it comes to Hamas. But just this past week, you've even had U.S. intelligence officials who have said to members of Congress that Israel had maybe put a dent into Hamas's military force, but is not able, not even close, to eliminate this group based on what they have even come up with, the conclusion they have made. And therefore, this puts out the question, then, what is Israel after? Does that pretty much solidify the fact that Israel is not after defeating Hamas, knows that it can't, but wants to displace the Palestinians, a war crime in itself?
You see, Israel cannot defeat the Palestinian people because the Palestinian people, you know, live in their own land and they resist. There is resistance from all the Palestinian people everywhere, you see, inside and outside Palestine. And then the Israelis are wasting their time by trying to commit more massacres, something like that, exploiting the total support or the blind support of the United States of America and Europe. So don't forget, of course, even within the Israeli war cabinet, there are divisions and And Netanyahu, corrupt Netanyahu in particular, is interested in continuing war, because once the war is ended, he will be taken to jail because of, you know, accusations of corruption, so on and so forth, against him. So in addition to those fanatic persons, religious Zionists, Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, and Netanyahu himself, because in Israel there is no left-left, you have right-wing parties who are bent on the destruction of the Palestinian people. And I think it is the responsibility of America to call for a ceasefire and to work for a ceasefire. And the Americans can do that if they want, just in one click. But the Americans and the Europeans are not interested in that, because they are interested in their own interests. And don't forget, there is gas worth billions and billions of dollars offshore of Gaza. And they are interested in gas, and they are interested in having Israel as their military base, in order to thinking that Israel can deter and can terrorize that part of the world. But I think now there is a resistance movement, an axis of resistance that can resist and will not accept. And I think I advise the Europeans and the Americans to stop their manipulation of minds and their false propaganda, and to come to reality and to ask Israel to end occupation of Palestine, take them back to Europe, and give the Palestinians their right to self-determination, right of return, and to implement all UN resolutions which give us all our rights as endorsed by the international community.
Well, Harish Stanger, you talk about how there needs to be a movement that needs to stop Israel, along with its accomplice, the U.S., from doing what it's doing. Now, if you want to solely look at people power in terms of protests that have come out, yes, there has been huge protests that have happened, somewhat unprecedented if you take a look at the numbers and how many countries were involved. But there are other movements that are doing that. One of them is Yemen's Ansar Allah movement, in which the Yemeni army has done what it can in terms of its focus being the Red Sea, of which is being blasted, where it says, you want us to stop the genocidal war. You have also Hezbollah, another resistance, part of this resistance, I guess, movements in this region, who is doing what it's doing. And of course, you have countries like Iran, Syria, and Iraq in its own way. What do you suggest?
Well, first of all, I think the people of Yemen are owed a great debt of gratitude from the world, because they're showing that you don't have to lie down and get run over by these imperial forces. Similarly, Hezbollah. The problem is that the way it's being portrayed in the U.S. is that this is really a war of Iran against Western interests, because there are people in the U.S. who want to destroy Iran. And this goes back to the Bolton, John Bolton. It goes back to the Bush-era neocons and so on, that are not just concerned with the Palestinians. They're trying to reshape the Middle East as a part of the imperial power of the United States and Europe. Now, what's interesting in these demonstrations, and I've been to a couple of them in Berlin, is there are a lot of courageous Palestinians who are out in the streets, but there are a lot of Germans who are joining them and who are saying that your fight is our fight. The same people are opposing the German support for Ukraine against Russia. So we're seeing a potential end to this empire, the empire of the dollar, de-dollarization. And so the resistance coming from the people of Yemen, from the Houthi movement, from the Hezbollah, is fine, but there needs to be more coming from the rest of the Arab world. And this would include the Saudis and others, basically saying they're not going to tolerate this. The one hope that I have is that the new motion before the International Court of Justice declaring Israel's attacks as genocide will be heard this week. And it's possible that the International Court of Justice will conclude that this is genocide and must be stopped, in which case they'll send it back to the UN Security Council. If the US vetoes it, then it goes to the General Assembly, and the vast majority of countries will vote against the United States and Israel. Then the question is, who has power to enforce it? And this is where the people of these countries have to come in. Do we wish to see our government slaughtering children and women and non-combatants in Palestine? Is that what the West is reduced to? And that's why this question of Nazi genocide is so important.
Sure.
Because the fact that the Israelis, supposedly representing the survivors of the Nazi Holocaust, are enacting a policy that's mimics what the Nazis did to the Jews, to what they're doing to the Palestinians, that's something that's a shame and has to be at the center of the discussion at the UN and in every national parliament.
Well, taking a look at the role that the Arab countries have played or not, Assad Abu Shar, we're looking at a very disturbing fact where you have, on the one hand, for example, what Yemen's Ansarullah has done, targeting U.S., U.K., and Israeli-bound vessels, where it has dented Israel's economy. But then you have Arab countries that have actually increased their imports from Israel, countries like Morocco, the UAE, Egypt, Jordan, and Bahrain, Morocco leading the pack at 128% increase. And also countries like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, who have allowed, and Jordan, who have allowed on the land route to replace the Red Sea region. I mean, this is a stab in the back of the Palestinians while Israel is committing the genocide against the Palestinians. So there's no hopes that really can be pinned there, can there?
You see, the Arab countries have been betraying the Palestinians ever since 1948, unfortunately. They did the same when the Israelis invaded Lebanon in 1982. The Israelis were committing massacres against the Palestinians and the Lebanese. And, you know, the Arab regimes were just watching the Olympiad. And they did nothing. And all they did is to evacuate the Palestinians. They are doing the same now. For example, when the Arabs are imposing strict starvation, strict besiege on the Gaza Strip, with the starvation of women, men, children, and everything, they are providing the Zionist apartheid state with food, with tomatoes, with cucumbers, with whatever, and they also established a land route from United Arab Emirates to Saudi Arabia to Jordan. They are, you know, providing them with food, whereas they prevent food from going to Gaza Strip, and they cannot force just a bottle of water into the Gaza Strip from the Egyptian border.
Right.
Also, Egypt also, you know, sends, you know, food to the Zionist entity. So the Morocco. So the Arabs can do a lot because, for example, if they stop at least their relations with Israel, if they use their financial power, if they use their political relations with the West, so on and so forth, they are not doing, they actually stab the Palestinian people in their
back.
And unfortunately, the Arab masses are helpless and couldn't do anything.
All right, we're going to unfortunately have to end it there. Thank you very much. Assad Abu Shar, Palestinian academic and activist from Dublin. Harley Schlanger, thank you. Spokesman at the International Schiller Institute, who spoke to us from Potsdam, Germany. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitali and the team, it's goodbye.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality. Back to
it's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, lovely friends from all around the world. Welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. This is Arab English Radio. Once more, I have the honor to be your host. This is Asma, and here with me I have two very dear guests. Sister Beta.
Yeah.
And Zahra.
And Sister Zahra. Well, assalamu alaikum, both of you.
Alaikum assalam, dear.
And you know the ritual. You have to introduce yourself very much briefly. Tell us about your background and let us know you more.
I'm Zahra and I'm a computer science student. I also attend HOSA and have finished my second stage studies in HOSA and I'm completing my degree in computer science.
So that's very good. Wish you best of luck.
Computer science and literature. And
what a combination.
Beautiful combination.
Yeah.
And I'm Bita, by the way, and it's a pleasure for me to be here again. I'm studying medical science, and that's it.
Yeah, thank you for being
You're
here,
welcome.
Both of you. Well, once more, I have the pleasure to sit here with these very dear guests. And as for today, we're going to have another interesting topic to discuss. Well, like always, you know, in here we discuss all the things that would bring us back to the real world. Yeah. And the realities of the world are not always so interesting. Sometimes there is this prevailing notion that goes everywhere that says if you do not have a heart, if you do not have emotions, or at least, let's just rephrase it in a better way, that if you do not use your emotions, it's going to be as a defense mechanism that would defend you from all the harshness and the possible consequences that might plague you with their difficulties.
Yeah. So like if you have a stone heart, you're not going to feel good things, but you're not going to feel bad things necessarily either.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, like, put on a defense mechanism so tough that nothing gets through.
But is it worth?
No, it's definitely not worth it.
No, for sure. You know, it was a time for me that I felt like I have to be so much strict and so much, for example, be like serious with all the people around me and show no feelings and no emotions in order to be serious, in order to be successful in this and that. And I was a teenage, by the way, at that time. And, you know, I wanted to be that. And even at this time that I feel like I'm just a bit more mature compared to that time, I feel like still I have this tendency in me that I don't want to show my emotions because I feel like showing emotions is a weakness itself. And I believe that this mindset comes back to your childhood. For example, the teachings of your parents, the teachings of
school. What we hear, they tell to a boy would never cry.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Those kind of, I don't know what to call these things, but these are destructive.
Yeah, these are not constructive, of course.
They probably just, you know, when you, as they say, when you bottle up your emotions, they're not going anywhere. You're just blocking them and just letting them build up and be undealt with till they turn into like a exploding force.
Exactly.
And when something really ticks someone off, it just gets let out, all of it. So usually people who bottle up their emotions are actually more emotional, but mm-hmm. they just can't express it. And therefore, they can't form good social connections because, you know, it's hard to become friends with a stone wall.
Yeah.
And at the very first place, why they feel like they have to hide it?
Usually
they have to bottle it up.
If they haven't learned how to properly manage their emotions, or if they've been constantly told off for their emotions, they end up turning to behaviors like this, which is destructive in parenthood itself as well.
Yeah.
So they usually end up raising children who are also
the same as their fathers.
Emotionally constipated.
Yeah, which is very sad, unfortunately. Psychologically speaking, if you go through traumas in your childhood, then when you grow up, you would develop some sort of fears. Like one of those fears is fear of abandonment, like fear of betrayal, and the anxiety. Most of these people who are inclined, who are more eager to keep their emotions for themselves and to hide it up, they all suffer from anxiety, mostly.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's a reflection of their disease. I call these things a sort of disease because, you know, as human beings, we all have to show it. What's wrong with it?
It's not a disease. You know, it's so harsh to call something like that as a disease.
What is it then?
It's a disorder. You know, I mean, there is organization for you. There is a kind of structure in order to live healthy. And when you go beyond this structure, because of so many factors that we may talk in this episode, is a kind of disorder, is a kind of things that you can solve it easily. It's curable, but
easily.
Not that easily. I mean,
no,
why
not easily?
I mean, you have to have this hope in order to, it will be solved, okay? And I don't know why you have this defensive mechanism over this thing that you have to show your feelings. No, not all the time.
No, I am not one of those
and
people who would
even
show her
showing
emotions.
Your feelings
every
has
now and
its
then.
Own limitations.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we talk about that talk after the break.
Okay.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Well, yes, we're talking about, is it good to show our emotion or no, and why is it so prevailing? Why people talk about emotions as if it's a crime that if you show it? Well, yes, this is Back to Reality. Sister Bita and Sister Zahra are helping us with this topic. So, we were talking about emotions, and then showing emotions is good, but you must be moderate. I feel this is the best way to put it. You have to be moderate. That spontaneous overflow of feeling at any moment is not the best thing you could do.
I believe this lack of balance in every field that you go through is the main cause of all the difficulties and all of the problems that we face. So when it comes to emotions, and at a first step, you have to learn how to control your emotions. I mean, before talking about showing or hiding emotions, you have to learn how to control them in yourself.
But the first question is, do I have to control my emotions?
Why not?
But no, really, why do I have to control my emotions?
Well, I guess the question, it's not so much about controlling your emotions, it's about managing your emotions. You know, like, as a parent, or as, you know, just a normal member in society, when you interact with people, you get angry, you get happy, you feel love, you feel
So why should I control it?
Because, like, you know, like, it's kind of like emotions have a flow. They're kind of, like, similar to water. If they flow outside of their channel, then it ends up turning into, it can turn into a flood. It can turn into a destructive
force. Like a volcano.
Force. Yeah. Like somebody can be like, I'm angry. I want to go smack somebody. I love somebody. I'm going to go, you know, leave
so
my family.
So anarchy would happen.
Yeah. But at the same time, if you don't let emotions flow, then things get dry and cold and people lose motivation to move, to interact, to, you know, live like human beings. And so if you learn how to manage them and put your emotions, that flowing energy, force, life-giving material into the proper riverbed, into the proper channel, then it's good.
I believe there is no sharp contradiction between emotions and logic. But most of the time, emotions do not follow logic. Okay, for example, you are so much angry that you want to hit someone. Is it logical? No. You want to do that? Yes. But you have to do that? No. Because this is not logical.
Sensibility check.
Exactly. So this is the answer to your question.
Yeah,
you need to be logical and rational.
So we have to be logical in this world. Yeah. At the same time, we have to manage our emotions. The reason that why we have to manage our emotions is because we are living in a sensible, apparently sensible world, and we have to go according to laws and rules. And those rules do not let me just go with the flow, just the way that I like to go. So now this is just one point to what we're talking.
Yeah.
But how can I control my emotion? Now that we came to this point that we have to manage or control or whatever word you put in that part, now that we came to accept it, so how are the ways to just manage it, to control it? Do we have narrations that would tell us that we have to control and manage our emotions?
I don't have anything off the top of my head, but I know there are many like narrations that we have about expressing your love, expressing your care towards your family members, your children, your spouse. Also about how, you know, we have an ayah that says, وَالْقَاذَمِينَ الْغَيْظِ, people who feel anger. It's not saying people who don't feel anger, people who manage their anger. So emotions are valid, they're affirmed. People should be feeling emotions because they're not humans if they're not feeling them. but they also need to be managing them. And putting a stopper to it, as in not managing, just controlling, blocking them, just creates that that flow of water to get built up behind a dam. And then one time when that dam weakens, it will explode and it will flood out and it will show itself in ways that are harmful to an individual and their society.
So I shouldn't keep it up. I shouldn't hold it inside myself. I shouldn't bottle it up. But at the same time, I have to manage it.
Let it express through its proper means.
Yeah, proper ways. That's very important, proper means. Like, for example, when we are angry, it's very difficult to think of the proper means. Mm-hmm. And the words just come out of our mouth without thinking about the proper means. What about you, Sister Bita? What are the ways to manage it?
I believe the first step towards the management of emotion is the acceptance that you have this feeling. Because most of the time when we feel like we are angry, we are jealous of someone, we are this and that, we deny it. No, I'm not jealous of you. I'm just happy.
No.
Oh my God. And you know, this behavior should be corrected at the first step. When you go through this acceptance of that feelings that you have, whether it is a bad feeling or a good feeling, you have to go and dig that feeling in yourself. Why? What is the reason of that feeling in you? What are the triggers that will actually put oil and these flames of emotions in you? And when you go through this process of thinking and seeking knowledge about your emotions, then is the time to know the methods of controlling your emotions. I believe the key attribute for controlling emotion is patience. When you are patient, you don't get angry easily, you don't get sad easily, you don't get
happy. So according to you, the best way to manage our emotions is to practice patience.
Exactly.
And according to you, it was to express it by the proper means.
Yeah.
So now if I just want to wrap it all up and make a gist of today's episode and put it in a nutshell, I would say that human beings without their emotions are just lost. So we need it, both the logic and the emotion. The logic would tell you how to express your emotions. And the ways to express those emotions is just as the sister mentioned, is by knowing the proper means. And according to Sister Bita, it's about your patience. And I would just put it this way, that as we grow older, as we start interacting as active individuals in society, we would learn the ways of controlling and managing our emotions. It's something that would come to you, that you would acquire by just growing older, by having more of interactions, by helping yourself develop mentally, psychologically, and even socially. All of these things would happen as you grow older, as you get to a stage of maturity. So I think we all have the ability to have emotion and at the same time to express it in the best way possible, and also to control it and manage it without just letting it kill us from the inside. Mm-hmm. And this is the key point, I suppose. This was all for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Life is full of choices.
Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In a press conference in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, Dayfullah Shami, spokesperson for the Yemeni government and Minister of Information, once again reiterated Yemen's stance that the U.S. presence in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden poses a real threat to international maritime navigation by militarizing international waters. As Shami stated that Washington's presence under the pretext of protecting Israeli vessels provokes the Yemeni army to continue its naval operations.
America is the source of real threats to navigation in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, and the presence of its forces that came from a distance of 9,000 miles to launch an aggression against Yemen under false and blatant justifications. They are to protect the ships of the Israeli entity and support it economically and militarily, and have nothing to do with securing international navigation.
Shami added that the U.S. and U.K. have launched over 400 air strikes against the Yemeni territories, resulting in the deaths of more than 40 soldiers. He asserted that neither Western aggression nor the U.S. designation of Ansarullah as a terrorist group will halt Yemen's naval operations in support of Palestinians.
The American designation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group is ironic. How can a terrorist classify those who defend themselves and their causes as terrorists? This designation shows U.S. no longer has any steps to take to stop Yemeni operations in support of Palestine. This classification will not affect Yemen's military operations, but may be a provocation for greater escalation.
Earlier, the leader of the Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, stated that no Israeli-linked vessel has sailed through the Red Sea in the past weeks, describing this as a major victory. He accused the US and UK of being the real terrorists for assisting the Israeli regime in committing war crimes against the innocent people of the Gaza Strip.
Yemen's official stance is clear. The Yemeni army's naval operations will continue until the Israeli war against Gaza stops. Officials say the United States designation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group will not help the US and UK achieve the objectives they failed to reach through military aggression.
Addressing women's health challenges and how they may affect the family, and particularly young children. Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Tajikistan, along with the WHO, coming together for the 28th time since 2005 to promote regional cooperation, an initiative by the Islamic Republic of Iran to improve public healthcare services.
Regional and sub-regional partnerships are crucial for effective implementation of joint regional initiatives and cross-border collaboration, and for detecting and responding to disease outbreaks and other man-made and natural disasters.
The challenges discussed in this three-day meeting will provide the groundwork for a much larger international health conference dubbed PAC for UAC, or Primary Healthcare for Universal Health Coverage, to be held right here in March.
This is the eighth time during Mr. Raisi's term in office that the G5 meeting is held. The main objective is to pinpoint the challenges that exist so that we can plan the upcoming PAC for UHC conference. The health sector of Iran has improved to a level where it can not only become a health tourism hub, but also share its valuable experiences with regional countries and help with improving health issues.
And while neighboring countries are dealing with a number of issues, they still could not turn a blind eye to the tragic situation of mothers and children in Gaza, living in dreadful conditions, now struggling to access safe water and sanitation, a basic human right.
We want healthy mothers to give birth to healthy babies, because that is the only way we can plan for the future of our societies. In Tajikistan, recently ratified laws are in line with this policy, and I hope that all women in different parts of our region can enjoy the kind of support we have in our country.
G4-5 Forum basically provides us an opportunity to learn from the weaknesses, from the challenges, and take a comparative disadvantage of each other from our strengths and experiences.
The ultimate goal is to provide universal health coverage and develop national roadmaps and strategies for improving healthcare services. Iran's initiative in this regard has allowed major advancements, and according to the World Health Organization, the Islamic Republic of Iran is now a role model, with its PHC, or primary healthcare network, extending beyond its borders.
These meetings will continue until February 15th, with the participants discussing the different challenges that they're facing, also paving the way for an international health conference that will be held in the Iranian capital in March. Gizum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Hezbollah's Islamic Resistance Movement has announced that it conducted a new batch of operations, with the count over 1,000. The hits recently include the targeting and destruction of espionage and technical devices in the radar post, which is situated in the occupied Lebanese Shabah farms. We can see the occupied Lebanese Shabah farms, where all military Israeli posts have been targeted and its hardware destroyed. Just beneath that, we can see the town of Al-Khiyam, which is subject to almost daily Israeli shelling. The resistance also declared it has used the heavy Falak 1 rocket to target the Ma'ali Golan barracks, while also targeting the Kila post in the occupied Golan Heights, in retaliation for Israel's aggressions in Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria. Several secret headquarters, including the 91st Division in the Galilee region, and gatherings of soldiers were also under Hezbollah's fire. Experts believe the confrontation is moving in an ascending ladder of events.
The Israelis are attempting to put pressure on the resistance by changing the rules of engagement, and therefore have begun with targeted assassinations. The resistance is responding in accordance with its vision of this battle, and is ensuring that it remains limited to the border region where it has the upper hand.
Journalists and cameramen are always on high alert in case sounds of explosions are heard to get some glimpse of a battle which seems unpredictable. Yet as Israelis go further, so will the resistance. Sheikh Jihad Asadi is a resident of the southern town of Shabah, but was forced to live further away from his town, which has been partially occupied by the Israelis since after the 1967 war. He says he keeps an eye on the Shabah farms to watch resistance rockets hit their targets and believes it will one day be liberated.
Netanyahu says he will withdraw from Shabah farms if Hezbollah withdraws to the north of the Litani River. We tell him that it is he who has to withdraw from occupied Lebanese land. This is the beginning of the end of the Israeli regime, and we advise all the Zionist settlers not to remain on our land, even if a truce is in place.
Hezbollah has also targeted several Israeli drones and lately hacked and confiscated an Israeli Skylark drone. With the scope of Israeli attacks amplifying, Hezbollah is flexibly adhering to the needs of the battlefield, whether in the quality or the quantity of their hits against Israeli targets or the armaments used. Maryam Saleh from Khiyam, South Lebanon.
An emergency protest outside the UK Prime Minister's office to try and stop an imminent massacre, called for by the Palestine Solidarity Campaign and a coalition of other similar organizations.
Week after week, pro-Palestinian protesters have come out in huge numbers to demand that the British government
call for a permanent, immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and to terminate its military and political support for apartheid Israel. And they're galvanized by the knowledge and hope that the pressure they're ramping up on the British government will eventually stir action.
In a sign of that pressure working, only hours before the protests, the UK's Foreign Secretary David Cameron joined other European leaders to caution the Netanyahu regime to think twice about its mass incursion into the southern Gaza city of Rafah, which shelters 1.4 million displaced Palestinians.
We are very concerned about the situation and we want Israel to stop and think very seriously before it takes any further action. But above all, what we want is an immediate pause in the fighting. And we want that pause to lead to a ceasefire, a sustainable ceasefire, without a return to further fighting.
Hands off Gaza!
Hands off Gaza!
Hands off Gaza!
But while that may seem like a change in the UK government's tone, the protesters here say it doesn't go far enough.
What kind of disturbed and dystopian world are we in? We're asking for peace is become slander. I just do not understand. I cannot comprehend what more needs to be done. Do they need to see 1 million Gazans being exterminated on their TVs or drowning in the Mediterranean Sea? Because that is the options that Israel is giving them.
Another demand here, an end to UK arms sales to Israel. According to the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, between 2015 and 2022, the UK licensed more than $500 million worth of weapons to Tel Aviv. Saeed Purza, London.
It's a day off for Zayed, a computer science student in New Delhi, hailing from neighboring Uttar Pradesh state. He wants to pursue a career in New Delhi, saying finding job is like a battle in this part of the world. But he is disappointed with the fact that elections are due and nothing more is important for politicians rather than stoking religious sentiments.
The governments have their own agendas to stay in power and they want to win over and over again. So the easy tool is to exploit people on the issue of faith. India's people from all faiths and the politicians want us to stay uneducated. So we won't question them on their policies. We should be talking about education, unemployment, healthcare, and good future for our next generation.
After the opening of a major Hindu temple in the town of Ayodhya last month, anti-Muslim sentiments are running high in India. In the Himalayan state of Uttarakhand, the demolition of a decades-old mosque and its seminary has led to deadly clashes. The violence is the latest incident of communal flare-up ahead of general elections. Muslim sites have become a new target of the right-wing Hindu groups. In recent weeks, top Muslim leaders urged the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi to end the religious dispute, citing a threat to communal harmony and calling for the protection of Muslim places of worship.
Since the BJP rule started in 2014, they are doing everything to destroy the country's secular credential. They are taking the country in the wrong direction by promoting Hindu first agenda to patronize the majority. But this country has a constitution which we trust and believe in. They raised a mosque in New Delhi last week, now in Haldwani, calling them illegal encroachment despite the fact they are decades old. They are selectively targeting a particular community, which is very unfortunate.
Experts say the demolitions are not confined to any particular region or state, but a deliberate attempt to demonize the Muslim community. Meanwhile, tensions have gripped the neighboring state of Uttar Pradesh, Bareilly city, after the arrest of an Islamic cleric who had called for protests against the demolition of the mosque. Human rights groups have called on the Indian government to halt this bulldozer campaign. Critics accuse the Modi's government of failing to address growing incidents of violence and hate campaigns against the Muslim community. They allege the ruling party is stigmatizing its critics and adopting policies that legitimize violence against the religious minorities. The BJP denies the claims, saying equal rights for all is enshrined in Indian democracy.
General elections in India are due in May 2024. Observers say many polarizing issues, including those related to Muslims, are being hyped in both social and political domain to garner public attention in the Hindu-majority India, where religion is used for electoral gains. Rights groups have accused the ruling BJP of selectively targeting Muslims, their homes, places of worship and businesses, calling it a larger political agenda. Munawwar Zaman, New Delhi.
The Iranian embassy in Yemen organized an event to mark the 45th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Senior Yemeni officials attended the ceremony to congratulate Iranian diplomats on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
Look to the Islamic Revolution from a strategic point of view. It's the first revolution that spread regionally and internationally to promote Islam as a concept, as a religion, and at the same time to give some strength to the people of this region. If not for the Republic, Islamic Republic of Iran, you won't see that we have a very high and loud voice all over the world.
The Islamic Revolution in Iran was positive and prompted the wide sector of the nation to take action in the great civilizational battle between Islam and infidelity. Therefore, it is considered an inspiring revolution for many Muslim and non-Muslim nations.
Yemeni officials highlighted how the Islamic Revolution served as a source of inspiration for their people, leading them to reject American interventionist policies, a sense that culminated in the 2014 revolution in Yemen.
The Islamic Revolution was inspiring to many Arab peoples, but the regimes oppressed the peoples and frustrated them with the support of the United States. However, the Islamic Revolution endured for 45 years and achieved many of the aspirations of the people of Iran. Today, Iran has become a major regional power that is feared by all countries.
In recent years, Yemeni-Iranian relations have flourished, particularly amid the U.S.-backed war on Yemen. This war, sparked by the 2014 revolution, aimed to reinstate a former regime aligned with the U.S. in the country. Observers say that victories of the resistance movements across the region are the result of the rise of the Islamic Revolution. They believe that without the Islamic Revolution, the Palestinian resistance would not have been able to withstand the brutal Israeli war with such strength. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The 45th anniversary of Iran's Islamic Revolution is commemorated in the Iranian embassy in Kabul. The event was attended by officials from Afghanistan's Taliban administration and foreign diplomats from several countries. During the ceremony, Afghanistan's deputy foreign minister congratulated the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution to Iran's special representative and emphasized his country's willingness to broaden ties with Iran.
We must emphasize that the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan wants to broaden ties with neighboring countries, especially the Islamic Republic of Iran. We are committed to deepen our relations with Iran in political, cultural, security, and economic fields. Once again, we congratulate this anniversary and wish to see mutual relations expanding between the two nations.
One of the aspects of the effectiveness of Islamic Revolution in Iran lies within our foreign policy. In this regard, our government have made numerous efforts to expand relations with other countries. Accordingly, one of our main concerns has always been to establish peace in Afghanistan. Islamic Republic of Iran, following the emphasis of its leader, has on its agenda to help the people of Afghanistan and strengthen good neighborliness, dialogue, and communication with the Afghanistan's authorities.
People in many countries were inspired by the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And of course, the Afghans were affected the most in 1979. The Islamic Revolution in Iran was a series of events that led to the overthrow of the Pahlavi dynasty in 1979.
The revolution largely affected many Muslim nations around the globe as it marked a significant shift in the political dynamics of the West Asia. It is believed that Iran's Islamic Revolution in 1979 marked a pivotal moment in its history with far-reaching impacts. The revolution played a key role in shaping the geopolitical landscape of West Asia and continues to do so. Abdullah Mirzada, Kabul.
Year 1402, slogan.